Welcome to Prognosis. I'm Laura Carlson. It's day 219 since coronavirus was declared a global pandemic. Today's main story? The NBA championships this week were cause for celebration for Lakers fans. But they also marked a victory over the virus. The league's bubble strategy resulted in not a single COVID infection among players or staff. So, how well do bubbles work? And what can we learn from them? But first, here's what happened in virus news today. Pfizer said it could seek emergency use authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S. as soon as late November. That's if the shot is shown to be effective in a large, late-stage trial. That timing squelches any notion that a vaccine could be cleared in the U.S. before Election Day. The timeline will be dictated by safety reviews, with the Food and Drug Administration requiring that at least half the study participants be watched for side effects for 2 months. That milestone should be achieved in the third week of November, according to an open letter published on the company's website today from Pfizer Chief Executive Officer Albert Bourla. Residents in London and Paris are bracing for tighter curbs on social activity starting tomorrow. Governments across Europe are attempting to get a new wave of coronavirus infections in check without crippling their economies. Cases are hitting daily records around the region, and Britain and France are two of the worst affected nations. Londoners will be banned from mixing with other households indoors, while the residents of Paris and 8 other major cities in France will be confined to their homes at night for 4 weeks. Finally, a new study that has not yet been peer-reviewed suggests the drug remdesivir has no substantial effect on a patient's chances of survival. A clinical trial by the World Health Organization that studied remdesivir and several other antiviral treatments, including hydroxychloroquine, lopinavir, and interferon, found that none substantially affected mortality or reduced the need for ventilators. According to the Financial Times, results also showed that the drugs had little effect on how long patients stayed in the hospital. And now for today's main story. The Los Angeles Lakers took home the NBA championship this week. But the close of the season also marked a big victory for the league itself. The NBA played its finals in a unique environment that came to be known as the bubble. Players were frequently tested and social distancing was heavily enforced. And the experiment worked. The NBA did not report a single positive coronavirus case from players or staff. I spoke to reporters Emma Court and Brandon Kochkodin about what's next for the league and whether other organizations can replicate its success. The NBA kept teams on the Disney World grounds and used wearable technology like the Oura Ring, which claims to detect early symptoms. They were also tested nearly every day using highly sensitive tests. Have any other sports leagues used similar measures?
Yeah, I think there's been debates about whether the Oura Ring actually works in terms of determining the early onset. What was picked up on by other leagues, though, the NFL and the Southeastern Conference in college football were a similar technology called these Kinexon devices. And that was, it was basically, a wearable contact tracing device. And so it would, it lights up when people get within 6 feet of each other. It keeps track of whether people are able to enter certain parts of a building or the stadium, and then obviously it tracks who were you close by. So certain elements of this are found, like I said, in the NFL and in college football. But whether the Oura Ring was able to actually detect early onset of symptoms, I think that's still up for debate and sort of questionable.
And this is like the holy grail, right? We're talking about figuring out if people are sick, tracking people, who are sick using technology. This is something that would be really widely applicable if we can figure out that it works. And I think what's interesting about why you're seeing these groups being used to test out the technology is that other parts of society aren't being tested nearly as much, right? We don't have this kind of data on you know, less valuable athletes, for instance, or regular people walking around in the US.
Yeah, that's a great point, Emma. With, you know, this is one of the things the NBA has kind of consistently tried to put out there is that, you know, in the wake of the controversy around should athletes testing be prioritized and this issue of, you know, whether their daily testing regimen was taking up, you know, valuable laboratory capacity from the general public, their argument has always been, we're in a sense a laboratory and we're, you know, kind of, not that they've used the term, but in a sense, guinea pigs for some of these technologies and strategies. And, you know, we saw that with their teaming up with the Yale laboratory around the saliva testing, which, you know, the NBA has been very proud to sort of tout that advancement.
I just wanted to piggyback off of that, which is a really good point, Brandon. And actually, a new kind of coronavirus test was pioneered using the NBA. It's you may have heard of it. It's affiliated with Yale as well. And this test uses saliva to detect COVID-19. And what's really interesting about it, and we've seen some other you know, versions of this test being used at the University of Illinois, at Champaign-Urbana, for instance, is that this test lets you kind of skip a step as you process the test. So it allows for much faster turnaround time. It's easy to collect, right? You spit into a tube, and it's really quite cheap. And it also allows you to use different kinds of brands of testing equipment in your while processing it in the lab. So you don't need to be reliable on a single source for these chemicals called reagents, for instance. It kind of hacks the traditional PCR test model and makes it a lot cheaper, easier to process, and, you know, more accessible.
And so, you know, continuing on that topic, it does seem that with all this technology, all this kind of investment in testing, the NBA didn't report one single positive coronavirus case. I mean, what do you think, what made the bubble so successful?
I mean, I think it's mostly that they had control of their environment and, you know, they had the daily testing, but, you know, people from Disney coming in and coming out, they were tested. You know, the contact with other people was limited. The NBA took very seriously that when people left the bubble, they had to go into a 10-day quarantine. So they were super strict about these things. And, you know, they did something that everyday Americans can't do. And that's, you know, totally control the environment.
And they had access to resources that, as you point out, many Americans don't have access to. You know, being able to quarantine before you go to work, for instance, or as you leave work and go into the community, like, that's pretty amazing. And I think also the access to testing is a big one. I mean, we've seen that overall picture change a lot in the U.S. There is a lot better access to testing, especially if you're a symptomatic person. But, you know, testing people, you know, as frequently as every other day, that's not something that's even close to the reality for most people in the United States. Most people in the United States, maybe they've been tested once, if at all.
And let's think about it also in terms of other sports leagues, you know, other sports, other, say, professional college sports are having a real tough time with preventing outbreaks, preventing positive cases. Is it possible for other leagues to create their own bubbles that are as successful as the NBA's has been?
Well, we saw the NHL do a similar bubble. They just had it on, you know, across two cities in Edmonton and Toronto. So there's a parallel there. But with regard to things like baseball and the NFL, you know, there are disadvantages that the NBA didn't have. And some of those are just, you know, bigger roster sizes mean many more people that, you know, would have to be included in a bubble. Baseball plays 60 games. I mean, the NBA and the NHL had an advantage where they were very close to their playoffs. So this wasn't something where they would have to play, you know, in the NFL's case, like a regular season of 4 or 5 months. The other thing is just, you know, Disney took the prime real estate here. I mean, you couldn't have hoped for anywhere better than than Disney, where you have all these hotels, you have the capacity to have this many people on site. For someone like baseball, I mean, there's just no, there was no equivalent place to go. I mean, some of the early talk was about putting all these teams in Arizona. Well, they would have been playing the season in July and August in Arizona, and there's only one temperature controlled stadium there. So, you know, the idea of having a bunch of these games held when temperatures are 100, 105, 110 degrees, you know, quickly sort of becomes inconceivable. And then with the NFL, I mean, again, it's just the sheer size of these rosters and the idea of where are you going to find enough football fields? I mean, just thinking about it in terms of the size of a football field versus a basketball field, there's nowhere else that you could create a bubble like this. And there's really just not, there's not another sport where there's this many fields available.
Has the NBA announced anything in terms of its plans for the next season, if it's going to go the bubble route or any other logistical plan?
They haven't yet, and they haven't even set when the start date for the new season will be. It was initially expected like maybe it would be on Christmas Day, and now it's looking closer towards January. And a lot of this has to do with the fact is, you know, let's be serious here, the NBA lost a ton of money because of this. I mean, they lost all of the fans in attendance. They don't want to do this again. This isn't something where this is a proof of concept and, hey, you know, if we have to, we'll go back to it. There's a significant amount of money on the line here. There was a significant cost of $150 million was what was reported for this. And, you know, they don't want to play another season without fans. So the idea of doing a bubble again to me just seems like a non-starter.
So as you both have mentioned, you know, this was a scenario that was fairly unique, fairly expensive, and not something that may be able to be replicated either in another sport or in general. But is there anything that we can take away from what we've seen in the NBA bubble? Is there something that the public can take away from how the NBA handled the virus, either when it comes to testing or the social distancing rules that they were enforcing?
I think to start, it's quite hopeful to have an example of where things did go well, because we haven't had a whole lot of that lately. And I'd note that the NBA bubble was conducted, you know, it started in the summer and it was conducted in Florida. So we're talking about it happening also in a state that at the time was a real, you know, becoming a real hotspot. And so their success, you know, really does say something.
That was Emma Court and Brandon Kochkodin. And that's it for our show today. For coverage of the outbreak from 120 bureaus around the world, visit Bloomberg.com/coronavirus. And if you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It's the best way to help more listeners find our global reporting. The Prognosis Daily Edition is produced by Topher Forges, Jordan Gaspure, Magnus Henriksen, and me, Laura Carlson. Today's main story was reported by Emma Court and Brandon Kochkodin. Original music by Leo Sidran. Our editors are Francesca Levy and Rick Schein. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. Thanks for listening.